On your journey through life, you are the hero. There are times, however, when it is beneficial to have an advisor to guide you along your path. Welcome to the Smart Money Simplified Podcast with Brent Mikosh, Certified Financial Planner, Certified Investment Management Analyst, and co-founder of MP Advisors LLC. In this podcast, Brent discusses some of the most important and interesting topics of the day as they relate to finance, the economy, and beyond. Now, on to the show.
Welcome to the Smart Money Simplified Podcast with your host, Brent Mikosh. Brent, good to be with you again. How are you, my friend?
Bill, I'm doing well, and it's always a pleasure spending some time with you. And I'm just going to open our conversation to say that this one's kind of painful for me because I got to give some credit to somebody from Boston, you know?
As
a guy that...
It's got a sting to be this early in the podcast and already having to give some credit to someone from Boston. It's got a sting.
I grew up in New Jersey. I spent 10 years in New York City. Boston's just always been a place that kind
big of...
It really does.
Yeah. I respect you for that view. Yeah, I wouldn't expect you to have any other view.
Exactly. But in this case, I got to give Boston some props for a couple of reasons. First, I got Brad Rutan on here. He is an investment product specialist and managing director that is leading the retail fixed income product effort for MFS. Basically, I refer to him. We do some business with MFS. It is the oldest mutual fund company in the entire country, I think, right? Is that the case?
We hit 100 years old next month.
Yeah, one of the cool things, too, is last time I was there at your headquarters in Boston, I think you guys have the original ledger.
We do.
From that original mutual fund sitting in basically the lobby, which is pretty cool as someone that's obviously involved in this business to see that.
But it's cool to see the companies that were around then that are still around today, that 100 years ago, you know, we were buying shares of, that are still, that name might have changed, but it's a cool piece of history.
Really cool piece of history. And so we love our friends over at MFS. And I've had the good fortune of hearing you speak a couple times. And most people, if we're going to talk about fixed income, we're going to talk about inflation, we're going to talk about, you know, what's happening with debt levels and everything else, it can make people's maybe, you know, fall asleep and doze off a little bit. But you're truly, all joking around aside, probably the most entertaining guy from that I've ever heard discussing fixed income and just kind of what's going on around the world. So
it's a low bar.
Yeah, it's higher than you think. But it was back, I think it was mid-January. You're out here in Phoenix, and met up with some people over there at Stake 44. But you gave, I think, some really good commentary on what was happening in the bond market and also beyond. And it was during that dinner where I just said, hey, I got to get you on. We got to talk about some of this stuff on the podcast so I can share it with my listeners. So, you know, with that, Brad, anything else I should be adding to that? And you want to talk a little bit about, you know, your path, I guess, to get to where you are right now, and then we can dive into some questions I've got for you.
Yeah, I took the path less taken, and I went to school for engineering, decided to become a chef, and ended up meeting my wife, who I knew from high school, and she was working for Putnam and got me into the industry back in, I think it was 2003, and then moved to MFS a year later and never left. Been here 18 years. We'll retire here and just, you know, love the markets, love talking to people, love trying to demystify, right? This we confuse the markets. We make it complicated, and it's nice to try to simplify it down to the basic building blocks: what matters, what doesn't.
Yeah, I think you do that really well. And again, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on today is because, you know, we've experienced this last couple years in the fixed income market. I tell clients, you know, we have the aggregate bond index, which for listeners is basically a big, broad measure of investment grade treasuries, high grade corporates. It's kind of like the Dow Jones or the S&P 500 of the fixed income world. You know, 2022, that index lost double digits. That's never happened. 10-year treasury bond lost about 13% in 2022. That hadn't happened since the late 1700s at the dawn of this country. So what we experienced in 2022 is really historic. There's no one alive that experienced the kind of fixed income market that we had in 2022. And last year was a little bit better. Saw some gains in bonds as yields sort of, you know, started to roll over a little bit toward the end of the year. But now we're getting kind of back in this environment where, at least, as of the time we're recording this now on leap day, actually, February 29th, ag is down, 10-year bonds down again. You know, rates are kind of slowly ticking up. And so I guess my first question for you is, can you put into perspective what we've been through as bond investors over the last 2 or 3 years and load a question for you, but where do you think it goes from here?
Yeah, we all grew up in this industry with the words negative correlation, right? That kind of float off our lips between equities and bonds. And that's generally is the rule. There are two environments where you should never expect that. And one of we've lived through both of them in the last 15 years. And the way I think about it is, if there is news about the economy or the labor market that's dominating the news headline, good or bad, right? It's we're heading to recession or massive expansion. If it's good news, well, you have negative correlations, right? And you'll see equities do well, but rates will come down. And if it's bad news, well, then you see rates come down, equities will sell off, bonds will do well. The other case is the reverse, right? If it's good news, you can see rates go up, bonds might not do as well, but equities are going to do well. The problem becomes when the major headline, everything you're talking about in the news, is not about growth and labor, it's about inflation and rates, liquidity. Now, again, if that news is good, think after the great financial crisis, right? Rates are low, inflation's not a concern, tons of liquidity. You had positive correlations between stocks and bonds, but nobody cared because everything was up. The only scenario where anyone cares about this is when the dominant headline, it's all bad. Inflation's too high, Fed's drawing out liquidity, hiking rates, and that's when you get positive correlations, but the bad type where everything's down. And that's what we lived through in 2022. The good news is it's a one in 150 year type event. It only happens when you have a massive surge in inflation, a massive Fed response, a massive risk off story that affects everything. And that was 2022. But the good news, Brent, is we rebuilt yields. And unless we go back to an environment where the Fed is hiking another 100, it can't happen again. Because we're either going to be going towards expansion or recession or somewhere in between, but the story is less and less about Fed hikes and inflation and more about the economy and the labor market and that. So I'm very bullish on bonds this year
And one of the things
because
I
of
want to
the
go back for
starting point.
listeners that might have a little confusion about negative correlation. What we mean is both Brad and I'm 50. How old are you, Brad?
I'm
Put you on the
50,
spot.
exactly.
But yeah, so basically our entire lives is essentially what you've seen, at least the last 40 years or so, is you saw this market where you had this negative correlation that was kind of in place, which way I put it is, the bonds in people's portfolios are meant to be kind of black blockers and tacklers, the sort of baseline of the portfolio that's going to protect you in an ugly market. The equities are hopefully where you're getting your growth. They're to use sports terms, they're the skill players and the wide receivers and the running backs and the quarterbacks and everything else. But what we saw in 2022 is those blockers and tacklers didn't do that. So you had the risk assets, if you want to call them that. They're all risk assets to some degree, but the riskier assets, which did still perform, generally speaking, worse than fixed income, negative. And you saw bonds very negative. And what that meant was to your average investor was, 2022 was one of the four worst years in the last 100 years for a balanced portfolio. You got to go the GFC, where equities were a lot worse, but bonds gave you a little bit of help. And then you got a couple of years in the depression, basically. And that's it. One of the things that you said here is you said that it can never happen again. I'm going to challenge you a little bit on that because I want you to convince me of that. We still have 10 years sitting at four, what, 4.25, 4.3, something like that, as the time we're sitting this, recording this rather. It's been six, it's been eight, it's been 10. There's been a lot of periods of time where that interest rate has been a lot higher than it is right now. What makes you think it can't keep moving up?
Well, one, you would need inflation to go back, north of six. You would need a massive inflationary cycle, one, for that to happen. When it was six and eight last, it was coming down from 14, right? It was on the way down. My question is this: could the 10-year treasury go to six? Sure, it's possible. The more important question is, can it stay there? Because it doesn't matter if it goes to six and then retreats right back to 4.3, in a month, there's no damage done. It's can it stay there for an extended point of time? And my answer to that is you hit six, you hit five, five on the 10-year treasury, and green buy lights are going to go off all over this world. Pensions that are looking to de-risk, institutional investors, international investors, where a six, a 5.5 on a AAA asset, you would see the demand go through the roof. And it's what we saw earlier when we saw the 10-year rise, and it immediately came back down because we had massive demand coming in from overseas. So it's not can it get there? I just don't think it can stay there, given the environment that we're in today and where global bond yields are too.
And kind of some follow-up questions to that. If you look at, the federal government's own finances, and this we touched on this briefly after we had dinner about a month or so ago, CBO's own numbers are basically saying that every single tax receipt that comes into the federal government is just going to support the debt by 2030. At some point, and not to sound alarmist here, but Mark Twain, great writer, when he went bankrupt, he was asked the question, "How'd you go bankrupt?" He said, "Slowly at first, and then all at once." And the thing that keeps me up at night from an investing standpoint is I'll buy one, two, three, or 4 year paper all day long. I don't want to go out much further than that because I am worried about the sustainability of the amount of debt that we are piling onto this federal debt right now. Does that concern you at all? Because at some point, investors are going to demand some compensation for taking that level of risk.
And as a dad, it worries me greatly, right? I have three young kids, and they're inheriting this mess that is not of our doing, but of our generation. But as an investor, as I think about it, the next 5 years, I don't worry at all.
I agree with that.
None. You get out 10 years, and now you're in a window. The one thing that gives me solace, and this is an argument I've or discussion we've had, and maybe we can have it. Until the US dollar isn't the reserve currency, it matters. It would matter more for every other country in the world to have the debt problem we do because they're not the reserve currency of the world. And the reason I mean that is, most of central banks still have to own US treasuries. 80% of business transactions in the world are done in US dollars. So we have the privilege. And it's a privilege, it's not a right, of being the reserve currency of the world. Most transactions are done in dollars. US treasuries are the most liquid. So until that changes, the world basically gives us a rope, a big one, to hang ourselves, but the rope is so long that the effect, and it's probably a 10-year problem if that, and it would require us to lose that reserve currency status. And maybe we talk about that. Maybe bring want to talk about the chances of that, or but that's really the key to me. It's all about reserve currency. As long as we stay reserve currency, Greece wasn't reserve currency, and they fell off a cliff because of their debt problem. Japan's had tons of trouble because they're not the reserve currency. China now, and is had. So if you're not the reserve currency, you don't get a free pass. We have a free pass right now. It still worries me as a dad.
Now, I do want to talk to you about that because, I put out there shortly after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. It's up on my YouTube channel when the talk was kicking Russia out of SWIFT. And at the time, I said, colossally stupid mistake. And like most of what the federal government does, I'm a very libertarian guy, they made the colossally stupid mistake that I don't feel like we've experienced the outcome yet. What I mean by that, we basically took Russia and massive commodity producer and remove them from the financial system that we, as we both would 100% agree with, have been a major beneficiary of the fact we issue
Huge.
the reserve currency. That allows us to do a lot of stuff that no
Right.
other country on the planet can do. And for the first time, you had people in charge that decided it was a great idea to weaponize your own currency. And that, to me, was colossally stupid. And I think that you're starting to see some of those cracks. We can talk. I do want to talk about how long it would take to maybe change reserve currency status because that's, to me, I agree with you. That's not a tomorrow problem. That's a 10 to 15 year problem to
Right.
unwind the global economic system that's been built around the US dollar. But we've already taken that first step to show the world that we are unreliable because your money's not safe. You're not, I wouldn't say it's not safe with us, but it's not as safe as it was when it was viewed as being apolitical and not something that would be weaponized against countries that maybe the U.S. State Department now doesn't agree with.
Agreed. But let me throw it back. Give me another currency that is a good alternative. And it's so I agree. Like, we took a step down in a trust, or I guess trust in the dollar when we did that. But right now, what currency is even close to that level of trust? I mean, the yuan is a joke, right? I was in Santiago 2 months ago, and I went out to a winery to talk to some farmers, and I wanted to hear from them. I said, would you ever transact in renminbi, yuan, euro, yen? And I'm not joking, Brent. They laughed. They literally kind of doubled over, and they're like, not, there is no chance, because they want their livelihood, their farm, their winery. You know, they want it tied to the most trustworthy, to the most liquid, to the most recognized, and that's it for them. There is no question. They can't be tempted away from that. So China can try to nibble away at little corners and strike deals, but you have a closed economy there, in a currency that you can't really trust. So that's out of the question. And the euro and the yen are just so much smaller that they can't handle the volume that the dollar and the treasury handle.
And I agree with all those assessments. I think that, you know, if you look at China's currency, absolutely untrustworthy. And I would argue the yen, the euro have problems that are far greater than the U.S. dollar. My question to you would be, you hear some rumblings now about BRICS, perhaps some kind of an asset-backed currency that is somewhat insulated from the political manipulations that every single central bank on the entire planet is doing. Do you see that ever getting any traction?
I think it could. I think when you think of the developed world, do they really want to go away from the dollar? I mean, you could say in Europe, they get annoyed at times, but it's working pretty well for them too. And do they want to see the breakup of that? Does that really benefit them? The stability that's been built around it. The euro would be a disaster. I
agree.
I'm a euro. Like, I think the euro itself is going to be the worst experiments ever when we look back in 40 years. So I don't think there's appetite even from them to have the euro be. So I think the developed world carries the torch to keep the dollar. You get these little pockets of dissension, you know, more in the emerging markets, but it's still an emerging market versus developed world. And in that world, developed wins, dollar wins.
So how do you think, you know, we both look at the debt load that's being, you know, increased, that the federal government is basically spending, adding to our overall debt. How do you think this gets reconciled? Because at some point, you know, momentum just becomes too much, where the interest to service the debt, it blows everything else out of the water. And I don't see a way. The only way I see this is really one of a couple options that the federal government has. You can go like Javier Milei style down in Argentina, who radically slashed government spending and took a 5% structural deficit. Basically, now he's got surplus, and he did it in 9 weeks. So it's definitely possible. I don't see the political people in charge in this country right now willing to take that step. Flip side is, you can tax the daylights out of Americans. There's not enough rich Americans to pay this level of debt. To me, that's the common misconception that is always shocking to me. Like, let's tax the rich. It's like, first of all, you're already extracting far more from the top 1% today than you ever have at any point in history. And you could seize every asset of every single wealthy person in the entire country. And once again, you'd be out of money in short order. So there's not
enough. Half of them would leave before you got finished taxing them.
And half of them would leave. And the numbers are so astronomical in terms of what they're spending. There's just not enough. You know, the third, and this is the one that kind of concerns me the most, and it definitely impacts fixed income, is the Federal Reserve monetizing it.
Yeah.
You know, and what does, all of a sudden, in a world where, you know, you got 34, 38, 40, $50 trillion worth of federal debt that just to support the interest payments, you got the Fed coming in there monetizing it. All of a sudden, I don't really, 4.3% doesn't look so great for me on the 10-year. I might want 10. I might want 12% on that.
Right.
Do you see that as a realistic concern?
I think it is. You know, it's funny. I think the way that this gets solved is we get a third legitimate political party. I think the two-party system is hogtying us. You're either this or you're that, right? In most countries I visit, there's, there aren't two. Sometimes there's too many, but it forces, having three, four, five, 10, whatever, it forces you to actually to get buy-in from other parties to form a government, where then you can accomplish something. Right now, it's left and right. Right. And there's no ability to come together and solve this problem. I think we need a legitimate third party in this country, to break up this just monopoly of two parties that, are at the greatest odds ever, and with the greatest problem we've had ever, the debt, and they can't solve it because they're just at odds. That third party would allow for more negotiation and potentially a solution, but eventually we have to cut, we got to cut some expenses, and we got to stop issuing this amount of debt.
Well, I'll tell you what's interesting is I view the I don't really view us as having two parties opposed to each other in the sense that I think we have two parties that are incredibly good at taking the very divisive social issues and pitting the American people against each other based on those issues. But the trajectory, it doesn't matter if a Democrat's president, a Republican's president, who's in charge of Congress, Senate. It's amazing that they always agree in spending a boatload more money. There's never a question about that. So it's like, you're bickering here and here, and you got the two teams apparently that are fighting each other. And I think they make a decision who's going to be the Washington Generals this time, and kind of swap it back and forth. But
Like
I agree with you.
I take it like my kids, Brent. I have twins and a 12-year-old. If the twins are left alone in a room, it's battle royale, and it's no holds barred, and they're just gonna beat each other up. Bringing my daughter, the third person, and like a negotiation will be made, and progress will be made. Leave the two of them in the room, and it's a war. I just think that additional party. But you're right. It's toxic right now, and I just think we need a third party to break the stranglehold and make it more of a, all right, we got to figure out how to get this done, like most other countries do. Most countries don't have two parties.
Well, let's take it a little closer to home because, that's a longer term concern that I really have. And I hang on to hope that it'll get resolved because I think I've used this quote several times. I think it was Winston Churchill that said, you can always count on Americans to do the wrong thing until they're forced to do the right thing. And then normally that occurs. And I think that, at some point, there will be a resolution one way or another. But closer to home, I'm curious your thoughts on this. I think that the inflation numbers, I was surprised the last one that came out was a little hotter than people expected. And that surprised me because one of the things that we talked about, I think about 6 weeks or so ago, was the inputs in the CPI, particularly around housing. All these things should be trending in the right direction. And do you want to comment a little bit on that, about what you're seeing on the inflation front?
Yeah, it's it, it we still have a ton of conviction that the trend is down, but you're gonna get bumps. You're gonna get seasonal data. You're gonna get the government, who actually came out, I think it was today, and said, "Hey, we made a lot of mistakes in that data release. We're gonna have to revise it. So just don't put too much emphasis in it." And then you also, we talked about housing is a big component of core inflation. And we talked about that when the Fed hiked rates, back in 2022, the growth rate of house and rent prices started, to decline real time. But inflation didn't pick up that trend because there's a lag. What now we're seeing is the lag is holding over, is lasting a little longer than we thought. Because think of it, if you are buying a house or selling a house and then buying a house, you might not do it today because of where rates are, right? So we almost
100%.
have had this lock, where we have this locked up effect in pricing. The real price of housing, we call it price discovery, isn't fully there because a lot of people have just backed away from the market and said, I'm just going to wait. So the you only find the price of something when it transacts. And since we've had lower, existing house sales, new home sales, et cetera, we're seeing less price discovery, less real price out there. So the component in inflation had a tick up, but we do think that the pressure is there. It will come down, and maybe it takes the Fed cutting, which is weird, to free up that inflation to come down, causing rates to come down and causing more housing transactions to happen.
Yeah, I can definitely concur with that. And I think one of the things that we can sort of clarify here is, that housing data, it's like half of the it's half of the inflation number right now is basically shelter. Is that right?
Correct.
About that?
Correct.
And, and the federal government's looking back on what, 3 years worth of data?
Yeah, the way they do it is they survey everybody and ask what's your rent price right now, or let's just say that. And you might have signed a new lease last month, right? And that's a good barometer for maybe what rent prices are doing today. I might have signed a new lease 3 years ago or 2 years ago, and my rent price tells you nothing about the current market. So the way we collect data, we're good at a lot of things in this country. I don't think collecting data is one of them. It's just too big of a country. But that's the lag, is you need to wait for my lease to roll off. I sign a new one, and now my lease reflects current conditions. Their data just collects stuff that really has no bearing on the current trend. It's just a poor system that they collect data with.
And to your point of the market being locked up, I mean, I'm a prime example of that. I was talking to my father about a week or so ago and said something about, we could use a little more space. The kids take up a lot of room in the house. He's like, oh, why don't you move? And I said, Dad, I said, I got 3.1% mortgage. Anything that I'm gonna, if I sell my house, anything I'm gonna buy is gonna be a bunch more. I gotta refi my mortgage up 3.5 percentage points at least and take and add to the debt load to do it. It's like I'm not going anywhere, you know?
Who thought that your mortgage would become one of your biggest assets?
Yeah, it's seriously, and I'll tell you, just as an aside, I think it's a great story. The mortgage broker that I use, I was looking to refi the just before when rates were just starting to tick up, and I'm like, I was like, I want to get sub three. I'm like, call me then. And she calls me up on the phone. She's like, you're an idiot. She goes, refi this now. And I almost did it out of spite. I'm like, I'll come back and I'll refinance again in, 6 months, and never got that chance. And so, yeah, I'm glad it did work out that way.
I'm glad that decision role played out the way it did.
Exactly,
Can you
exactly.
imagine, like millennials got shut out of, the GFC, kind of disrupted their path to success or economic growth, family creation, and now they're dealing with a lot of them are shut out of housing. Like they can't, that increase in rates has made housing unaffordable. So,
I got a lot of love and affection for the millennials. I think they get a bad rap because
I
you're
do
right.
too.
They dealt with the wake of the GFC. They were sold a bill of goods with the college debt that they've accumulated, which they can't discharge. And you're right. They've been on the wrong. If the boomers hit everything historically, like at
Perfect timing.
perfect
Yeah.
timing, they've hit everything at really challenging times. I got a lot of love for any
You imagine being
millennials that are out there.
36, having graduated GFC, no jobs. And then you go, you have a period where it's tough, and then you hit the like you're 36, and now you're trying to create a family, and now you're dealing with the highest rates we've seen in, 40 years. It's yeah, I got a lot of love too.
Yeah, exactly. All right, but to your point though, I do think that in the shorter term, I agree with you, where I think that in the longer term, we could potentially have more inflation than what we're dealing with today. And
Correct.
inflation tends to come in waves. You look back in the 1970s, there was three big waves of inflation, and I think we probably saw the first wave. Whether we see the next two, I don't know, but I do think we're going to see, those inflation rates come down to maybe 2-3% before this is all said and done, which in the short term is going to be a real good thing. Looking at the fixed income world. What do you like? Where do you like to be right now? What kind of debt you looking at, and where you want to be on the yield curve?
Yeah, I think the easiest, again, if we can go back to 2022, which hurt, a lot of people are still reeling from that. The easiest layup, is a basketball term, is short duration, high quality, because those yields are still, so a year and a 2 year bond, let's just say, is significantly higher than the yield on a 10 year government bond. And we know the Fed probably isn't gonna hike again. I'm pretty sure of that. We believe they'll start cutting in July, June, July, but maybe they wait a month. But eventually the Fed's going to cut. And when they do that, shorter bonds are going to react more, meaning those rates are going to come down and their prices are going to go up much more than in the intermediate or long term. So, and you're not taking that much risk. It's high quality. These are 2-year bonds from companies like Coca-Cola, Walmart, names that you know are going to be around in 2-3 years. Like maybe they're a little more healthy, a little less healthy, but they're going to be around and they're going to pay their bonds so that they can borrow again. So what's the risk you're taking? You're buying in at yields of 6. You're investing in companies, investment grade, high quality companies that are going to be here when their debt matures, say in 3 years. You're getting a massive premium in yield. And if we're wrong, and the Fed starts to hike or rates start to rise, you take less rate risk along the way because shorter bonds have less interest rate risk. So I think that's the easy one. If you just want to get in the water, shorter duration, high quality bonds, to me, it is a no-brainer. And I don't think there's much downside to that trade.
I 100% agree with you on that. Now, what if we want to go down, and this is not a big part of our business. We generally, we stay away from lower credit quality, but let's say you go down the credit quality spectrum. Where are the spreads right now, and what's that market look like?
Yeah, it's not attractive. Like the spreads, even in investment grade, longer bonds, the spreads are not attractive right now. So what we're doing is we hold corporates, let's say in just an average fund that's something like the ag. There's corporates we own because we want to own them through the next 10 years. And it doesn't really matter what happens in between now and then. We know they're going to be here in 10 years. They're going to pay off their debt. We're going to make our income. But we're light on high yield. We're light on lower quality investment grade and just kind of sitting in and waiting. If we have a recession, you're going to get a better buying opportunity for that lower quality. It always happens. So if I did need to go down in credit quality, I would probably go emerging market debt, actually. We are seeing, more attractive yields, spreads, as we call them, extra yield that you're getting to take on that risk. So I'd prefer emerging market debt over high yield if we wanted to go down in credit quality.
And where are you looking around the world for that?
Oh, it's lots of great places. I mean, Mexico, that now is the biggest trading partner country-wise with the U.S., Canada being second, China now being third, massive beneficiaries of this onshoring, friendshoring, reshoring, anywhere, Latin America and Uruguay and Chile, even Dominican Republic, that's very tied to the U.S. economy. Every country has some bonds of some company, or maybe it's the country, where there's value. It just takes a lot of time to sift through it all, figure it out, what should we pay for it, and get it into the fund. But, even in the Philippines and Indonesia, Azerbaijan, there's a gas company on all their gas lines go around Russia into Europe. None of them, it just how they're built. So those bonds have performed great as obviously, the gas situation with Europe and Russia was a problem. It's just locating them.
Yeah. How you feeling about munis right now?
I love them. I probably shouldn't say this, but that's an area that my family has increased our holdings because your yields are good. The fundamentals or like the health of municipals is very good. The only thing that's holding them back is ever since the Fed started hiking, billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars have left munis because people were afraid of rates rising, and that money hasn't come back in. But let's be clear, munis have a monopoly on tax exempt income for the most part, and that won't stay that way forever. I mean, the outflows won't stay out forever. Money comes into munis for a reason. It's a great deal. And once you get that inflow and match it up with good yields and good fundamentals or good health, look at every other outflow cycle that's ever happened. Anytime that, remember Meredith Whitney?
I don't. Who was that?
So she came out and claimed that there was going to be hundreds of billions of dollars of muni defaults. This is back in like 2011.
I do now, yeah, that rings a bell.
Remember?
Yeah.
Yeah. And she was dead wrong. I think there was like one default, but people, money came flying out of munis for a while. When the money came back in from that point, the next year or two, you had double digit gains. And every other outflow cycle, when it ends and money comes in, think of it as a tailwind, more demand, prices go up. Usually after an outflow cycle, and this has been the worst in history, the worst, the longest. So the snapback, I think, is going to be one of the best.
Very cool. Okay. And I want to end on kind of an optimistic note here is, whenever I get into this stuff, and Bill knows this, particularly around some of the decisions made fiscally by our federal government, I'm actually really on board with what the Federal Reserve's done. I think the Federal Reserve has actually managed this so far pretty well. But, I do think, and I want to reiterate the fact that if you look around the world, and you kind of touched on this as well, you don't want to be in China. You
No.
don't want to be Europe's deindustrializing right in our face. You don't want to be there. You can make an argument for some places in Central and South America, but that's a little, it's a little risky as well. But what do you have here in the United States? You still have the reserve currency, like we talked about. You still have a young, generally educated workforce. You got plenty of land. You got plenty of water. You got the youth is on our side as opposed to a lot of other places around the world like China. So this is by far, I think, the best. I'm hugely optimistic on America. And I think one of the reasons that I get so frustrated, and that does come through in these conversations, is because I think we need to hold ourselves to a higher standard. I mean, we're still the best house on a block of real, shaky houses around the world. But we got to hold ourselves to a higher standard. We have to hold, personally, individually, we do. Our leaders, we've got to hold them to a higher standard. The corporate citizens we have out there, we've got to hold them to a higher standard. So I am optimistic. But with that in mind, my last question for you is this: is you've had, real colorful history in terms of even getting you here, and a lot of experiences once you've been involved in this world. What are some of your best lessons that you've learned about life and investing as you've gone on this journey?
What I've come to appreciate is to break things down to the simplest form, like the reserve currency, right? Like we talked about, and you think of China and everything that's going on. You just got to go to demographics. It tells you the whole
Disaster.
story.
Disaster over
Disaster.
there. Yeah.
And so I've learned to we complicate that. There's so much everyday news, and people want to sound smart when they talk about it. But at the end of the day, it's simple, but it's hard, right? It's actually simple. It's just very hard to do. So I think that's one lesson. Two is humility. I'll be the first to tell you, let's do this in 6 months, and something I said is going to be wrong. This is a batting average industry. No one can be right even 80% of the time, because it's not a science. There's no laws that saying equity has to go up or down based on something. Like, there's other things involved. So humility to understand that we're going to be wrong, and learn from it, figure out what happened, move on. Don't be ashamed of it, own it. That's really something that at MFS, in the culture, is just humility to understand that we're going to do our best. And then when we don't do our best, we're going to learn from it, move on, and try not to make that same mistake, if you call it, or misjudgment.
Well, one of the things I recall, the first time I heard you speak was the tail end of 2021. So we're right coming into the bond market that we had, which was historic in 2022.
Yeah.
And you said back then, you made some comment, I'm going to paraphrase, about how trying to make a prediction on which way rates was going to go is almost an impossible task.
Yeah.
And you said at some point we're going to have some kind of dislocation in the bond market. And it's going to create a lot of opportunity. And I do think one of the things, particularly in the fixed income world, that I've been saying to clients is, honestly, if we can get through that pain, which we did in 2022, the world that we're in now is a total gift, because I can sit there and get north of 5% on cash, for Pete's sake, versus zero, not that long in the rearview mirror. So I think that the amount of opportunity out there, I think, is incredible. To your point, countries and companies in this country are going to continue to innovate and grow and come up with great ideas and, yes, pay their bills once when they do that. So I'm really optimistic for the future, moving on. But Brad, man, I appreciate it. I always enjoy our
Me
discussions,
too.
and I think you take something. The bond world can be a little bit complex to those that are not in it every single day, and I think you break it down in a really great way that I certainly I'm glad we had this conversation. So thank you.
Let me close it out with Bob Dylan, one of my favorite singers. He sang a song, and in it, one of the lines says, "Behind every beautiful thing is some type of pain." And if you think about it, it's very true. But the beautiful thing is the bond market right now. We went through the pain. You had to go through that pain to get the beautiful yields and environment that we're in. We wouldn't be talking about fixed income if we were still at zero yields or one yields. You had to go through that pain to restore the yield and create the beautiful outlook that we have today. So we'll end with Bob Dylan
I like it. Thank you.
today. Bill, great to meet you as well.
Yeah, nice to meet you, Brad. I just want to add an observation because I admire Brent and I admire his optimism and everything else, and I cling to the hope that he's right. You mentioned in the conversation about the reserve currency is a privilege, not a right. But I would also say coming with privilege becomes a responsibility.
It's true.
Responsibility demands accountability. And I don't see anybody in this political equation, this uniparty or whatever you want to call it, equation that says we have to be accountable. So if you don't mind, Brad, I just want to, I'm curious if either one of you see a coming of just accountability and responsibility here.
I think, Brent, you kind of touched on it. I think we've gotten a little lazy as a country. We got used to being the best military, the best economy, the best innovation, the best country, the best legal system, the best property rights. And we got lazy and just figure, I just don't think we stayed on point. So I think we need that accountability. I think back to the politicians when I was growing up, and on both sides of the aisle. Whether it was Tip O'Neill or Ronald Reagan, they talked to each other, and it was about the country. It wasn't about, to your point, like catering to to the party. It was about your constituents, who are people, who are Americans, and we're all in this together. That doesn't happen much today, and that's why I feel like having a third party, and I'm a libertarian, just breaks up
I
the.
knew that's why I like
Yeah, totally. But right, it
it.
breaks up that it there's just two arrows going right now. Once you get a triangle, now you can work differently. And I just think it would break up this, lack of accountability, and it's your fault. No, it's your fault, and the finger pointing and back in the corner. But I think you're right. The good news is, what country is accountable? Like what country is acting in the best way? I mean, you have Germany who relies on coal and industrial, and they have the most aggressive green energy policies in the world. They basically are killing their
Destroying
economy,
their own country.
destroying their own country. Like, so are they accountable? I guess. Is it smart? Probably not.
And I think it, to your point is I think Bill, to two things. First, reality always wins. And so when the unreal can persist for only a certain amount of time before reality comes and wins.
Yeah.
But I think to your point, Bill, is
I
we
like
as
that.
a people, we got to demand more of our leaders. And to your point, Brad. I've voted libertarian, just being fully transparent, almost every single
Yeah.
election, because I looked across the landscape and I'm like, I don't like any of these people because
No.
they're not working, they're not doing what the Constitution says that they should be doing. And so that's where I stand on that. But then you look at,
They're
you
fighting
can't
for their
rail against
party,
this.
not for the country.
Exactly. It's
Yeah.
100%. But you can't rail against what these politicians are doing if you don't vote. And
No.
Almost no one, you look at the primaries, it's like, you're talking to your neighbor, you're having a beer with him or something that he's, angry about this politician did that and whatever. And oh, did you vote in the primary when it came through? No, man. Did you do the school board? No, I didn't have time for that. Well, that's, come on. Then you're getting what you deserve. But the problem, I think, for guys like the three of us, which I'll assume, is that, we are the recipient of everyone else's apathy. And
Right.
everyone needs to wake the heck up. If you don't like what's going on, get out there and vote. And these people is a great podcaster I like, and I'll leave it with this. Politicians should be treated like rental cars. They're nothing more, nothing less. Are they the vehicle to get you where you want to go or not? And then once they get you there, Drop them off and forget about them. I don't want cults of personality. I don't want politicians that are telling me how to run my life. They're rental cars. All of them are rental cars.
Career politicians. That's a bad idea.
It's a terrible idea because it's an insular world and they have no idea what's going on around the country. And we could spend 3 hours on that. But Brad,
we could wander off without a path.
Last solution, because we talked about raising taxes. Here's a solution that will solve one of these problems, the deficit or the apathy. Slap a 5% tax on anyone that doesn't vote. Either you solve the deficit because no one votes and you collect money, or you solve the account. One problem gets solved. Either everyone votes because they don't want the tax, or no one votes and then you get money from people that aren't accountable and they help close the budget deficit. That's my idea for you. You can run with it.
There we go. For president. I like it.
Great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you as well. Brent, before we get out of here, how can people who want to talk to you get a hold of you?
Yeah, absolutely. So pretty active on LinkedIn. I post stuff up there almost every day. Office number here is 602-255-0555. Either myself or Andy or Kayla or a member of the team will pick up. Or you can go to mpadvisorsaz.com or smartmoneysimplified.com. And that's taking the same website, has all of our contact information on there.
Super. Thanks so much, Brent. And for those of you who are listening to the podcast who are not subscribers, I don't know why you're not, and it's easy to become one. Hit the subscribe button. That way you will be automatically notified whenever Brent produces a new episode of his podcast. You don't have to remember like where or when you heard it or when it comes out or any of that stuff. The other thing we'd like to ask is that if you like the podcast and you enjoy it, tell people about it. People know what Brent's talking about. He has great conversations all of the time in this podcast. It's worth subscribing and telling people about it. In the meantime, until next time, I'm Bill Tucker on behalf of Brent and everybody at MP Advisors. Thank you for listening, and I would remind you that you can go out today and make today a great day. Or not. It's your choice. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Smart Money Simplified Podcast. Have any questions about topics covered during the show? Visit www.smartmoneysimplified.com or give us a call at 602-255-0555. Don't forget to click the follow button below to be notified when new episodes become available. The information covered and posted represents the views and opinions of the hosts and/or guests and does not necessarily represent the views or opinions of Raymond James Financial Services Incorporated. The content has been made available for informational and educational purposes only. The content is not intended to be a substitute for professional financial advice. Always seek the advice of your financial advisor or other qualified financial service providers with any questions you may have regarding your individual situation. Securities are offered through Raymond James Financial Services Incorporated, member FINRA, and SIPC. Investment advisory services offered through Raymond James Financial Services Advisors Incorporated, MP Advisors, LLC, is not a broker/dealer and is independent of Raymond James Financial Services.